Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of December 17th, 2010. It's one of the most important numbers in your life, but ask yourself what your credit score says about you. We'll have that in a moment. Meanwhile, what's that old chestnut about spend to save?
Better peace of mind for 40 bucks. It's covered for 2 years if anything happens to it. So,
we'll ask whether extended warranties are a deal or a dud. And tis the season for a mailbox full of holiday cards, party invites, and fundraising junk mail.
I received 66 address labels, 3 notepads, 10 Christmas cards, and a batch of Christmas gift tags.
What, no turtle doves? No, just charities hoping to tap the giving season. Those stories are coming up, but first, we've been asking you for your financial New Year's resolutions here on the show and on our Facebook page. One common theme in your answers is that you resolve to save more. Excellent goal, one that most of us should pursue. But saving doesn't come easy to Americans. And because of that, the retirement company's TIAA CREF recently held a competition for ideas that would prompt people to save more. Jonathan Chan won. He's a recent college grad, and we agree wholeheartedly with his winning entry.
My idea was to incorporate savings rates into the credit scoring system in the United States today. I thought the idea would promote savings because people are absolutely interested in their credit scores,
right?
Because it affects the ability to buy a home, borrow money to go to college, and be able to just borrow money in general. So I thought that incorporating credit scoring would make the borrowing base better. It would identify lenders who are better borrowers.
Well, and it's really interesting because the vast majority of your credit score now is based on debt and whether you've paid off your bills and how much debt you have and how much your credit card utilization is and that sort of thing. There really isn't anything about saving, is there?
Absolutely. Every aspect of the credit score has to do with spending. You have to build a credit history. You have to maintain a lot of different credit lines. And one large aspect was to get as many credit cards as possible.
Right.
So the person with the most amount of credit cards actually has a higher credit score.
Yeah. The person who dies with the most credit cards wins, right?
Exactly. So I thought those aspects were kind of anti-saving.
I'd say they're totally anti-saving.
Yeah, absolutely.
So why was this something that you were thinking about?
While I was in college, my first experience with credit scoring was getting my first credit card, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
I learned more about the credit scoring system, and I wanted to improve it. Not because I wanted to buy a home anytime soon, but I just knew any part of financial health had to do with having a high credit score. So doing more research, I realized that every aspect of the credit score had to do with spending, and I thought that system does not reward saving. And once I saw this contest by TIAA CREF, I knew that this was a system that could benefit from incorporating savings rates.
Well, how specific did you have to get for the contest? I mean, did you get as far as, trying to design this for the folks at FICO at Fair Isaac?
I did mention a few ideas. I thought incorporating into the tax system was a possibility.
How?
I thought that a few extra items included into the tax system could possibly calculate a savings rate. I guess everyone has an idea of how much they save, but they can't really put it in a number right now. And I think a few extra items on your annual tax form could possibly do that. And I also suggested a voluntary system through like a financial tool. I suggested Mint.com, and I said that a tool like that could possibly calculate savings rate and contribute to credit score.
Would your calculations, for example, take into account how much home equity you have, which is, a lot of people consider that a form of savings as well?
My idea definitely hinges on the fact that savings is not just cash. Placing money in a savings account is not savings. It could be part of savings.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to stress the fact that to be able to invest in home equity is absolutely savings, and I think my idea hinges on that too. And I think that in this economic environment, that was kind of crucial because the real estate market was so depressed, and something that would improve that would be a winning idea.
May I ask how your credit score looks these days?
I actually got my first credit card when I was a freshman in college, so my credit history is limited, and I think the only way at this moment for me to do that would be to keep spending, and so I think that needs to change. But otherwise, I've never been late on a payment. I've never gotten into significant debt, so I think I have a decent base for building my credit score from now on.
And you won $50,000. You know how you're going to spend that money?
I'm going to try to put my money where my mouth is. I want to save some of it. I do have some student loans outstanding, so I'll probably try to pay down some of that. But I just found out about winning, so I haven't really made too many plans yet.
All right. Well, Jonathan Chan, congratulations. And yep, I love this you. Idea. So I hope it absolutely launches you and gets some of us who are good savers a better credit score. That would be great.
Yep, I hope so too.
Thanks so much.
Yep, thank you.
And we asked the folks at FICO what they thought of Jonathan's idea. They told us it was a novel idea that they'd be interested in exploring. But right now, they don't have a way to calculate consumer savings. Their numbers are based on information they get from lenders and credit bureaus who, of course, are only interested in what you borrow. Ball goes to you, Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion. Happy to say I've got almost all my holiday shopping done at this point, neener, 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 which is more than some folks around our office can say, including self-admitted gift slacker Adrienne Hill. Now, to be fair, she's got more to think about than I do. She's a member of our sustainability desk with no small pressure to figure out how to give green this holiday. Here's her story.
Somehow, it's already the middle of December, and I don't have gifts for either of my sisters. Alex, a college senior, wants a dress.
I'm looking for something that I can wear to work and to class.
She points me to a dress from the online retailer ModCloth. It's on sale for $25 and was imported. It doesn't say from where. And I need a present for Allison, an early 30s professional who travels a lot.
Some jewelry that is simple, classy.
I'm thinking earrings. I'd typically spend $50 to $75. This year, I've decided to try to give green. I mean, I am a sustainability reporter. My first stop, a resale store called Buffalo Exchange, where people buy and sell used clothes and jewelry. I bring along my colleague Angela Kim to help me hunt. There's no jewelry that stands out, but the dress rack is more promising.
Oh, wow, there's a juicy couture dress here. It's only $38.
It's super cute.
Yeah, this would be like $100 easy at the store.
I'm pretty amped. Could it really be this easy? I head to the fitting room to try it on, to get a sense of it. Nope. No, thank you. It looks more Michelin man than college cutie. It might look better on her, but I don't know. Which is part of the problem with buying one-of-a-kind used. It can be cheaper than new, but it can take a while to find the right thing, and it can be hard or impossible to take mistake purchases back. So, on to the internet. Summer Bowen runs an eco-focused boutique called BTC Elements.
It's an online boutique where everything you purchase is both eco-friendly and fairly made.
Well on our way. We start by looking at earrings for Allison. Bowen sells some lovely earrings that are upcycled, made with tin from old cans, for around $30.
One of the cool things about upcycled materials is that you can get a good price point because basically what the materials are, they used to be waste materials.
She also has a pair of gold earrings made by a San Francisco designer from recycled gold. They cost about $60, which is just what I was expecting to pay. Allison will love these. Mission one, accomplished. The dress for my little sister is going to be harder. Bowen says new, environmentally friendly clothing often costs a lot.
It is more expensive to manufacture an organic piece of clothing than it is to manufacture a conventional piece of clothing.
Dresses on Bowen's website run from about $50 for a dress on sale to a few $100s. I don't see anything for Alex. I could get crafty and sew. That would cost about $30, depending on my fabric choice, but I'm out of time. So I decide to ask for help. I meet up at a mall with Jessica Lass from the Natural Resources Defense Council. What makes a good green holiday gift?
You know, what we're seeing is people buying experiences for each other.
She suggests taking a friend out to dinner, spending time together.
That's really the best green gift that you can possibly give to someone.
Which has me thinking I should take Alex shopping for a dress she'll like. Ideally one made locally, one that will last her a long time. That sounds fun and green, or at least greener than buying the $25 imported dress that probably won't last more than a season. It'll cost me more, but I can be sure she'll like it and won't spend the time and energy to return it. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace Money.
I wonder if you could argue that charitable giving is green. You're recycling goodwill, right? Not to mention your dollars? Well, here with some tips on planning your year-end donations is someone who knows more than a little bit about the topic. Melissa Berman is president and CEO of Rockefeller Philanthropy Advisors. Yes, that Rockefeller. Melissa, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You know, we hear a lot about kind of figuring out what your own motivation is for giving. It sounds pretty obvious. You know, I give to animal shelters because I love animals. But maybe it's a little more involved than we think it is.
You know, I think for many of us, we want to take a few minutes at this time of year, especially to kind of look inside and say, what are the things that I really care about? You really want to be able to tie the issues and the organizations that you support to what really moves you. You'll actually stick with your giving program longer, and you'll become a really great advocate for the organizations that you care about, and you'll help them get more money.
How much homework should we be doing before donating? How many people do you think really invest their time as well as their money to make sure that the donation is going to be used in the way they expect it to be?
Well, you know, I used to be a teacher, so I'm pretty big on homework. And I think that it's a terrific thing to spend a little time online so that you understand what kind of programs they have and how the money is going to be used to help people.
You know, I think there's still a big gap in trust between the public and companies in this country coming out of the financial collapse. And it's not just corporate America. Nonprofits are companies, too. People are really wary of just handing over their dollars, whether it be to buy stocks or to donate. What needs to be repaired there, and how does that happen?
You know, the trust deficit that this recession has created is a very significant issue. People give to nonprofits often motivated by faith and belief, and they hate to have those expectations dashed. I think that nonprofits probably have to be more thorough about documenting how they're using funds, who they're helping, and what a difference they're making. And I think those of us who are making donations also have a responsibility to learn how to ask the right questions. Why does this problem exist? How can nonprofits make a difference so that we can be making informed decisions and having a really informed discussion?
You advise wealthy individuals and corporate foundations on their giving strategies. Are those any different for kind of just regular folks who don't have huge estates, or is the advice pretty similar across the board?
No, the advice is really pretty similar across the board. Even the Gates Foundation doesn't have enough money to tackle every problem in the world. All of us have to sit down and say, I have limited resources. What are the areas that I really care about? And although it's really hard, it is better to take your dollars and spread them out across a smaller number of organizations than to just give every organization that asks you $10 or $20.
Melissa Berman, thank you so much and happy holidays.
Thank you. Happy holidays to you.
Melissa heads up Rockefeller Philanthropy Advisors. Picture this. You're about to buy some high-tech gizmo, little holiday treat for yourself. Suddenly the salesperson says, wait, you should buy an extended warranty, you know, to supplement the standard one from the manufacturer. What to do? What to do? We asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer to find out whether extended warranties are warranted.
I bought an extended warranty once in the 90s on a boombox. I got the pitch for the extra coverage at the cash register. It sounded a lot like this pitch at a Best Buy in the Maryland suburbs of Washington.
Any kind of normal wear and tear, power surge, heat, dust, humidity, stuff that happens when it snows and the power goes out.
I said yes, just like this customer did. I mean, what if the boombox broke before the manufacturer's warranty expired? So I ponied up an extra $25 for the extended coverage, and I never used it. That boombox is indestructible. It traveled with me to Budapest, Hungary, then Bosnia. This grizzled war veteran now resides in my son's room, where it is tormented by toddlers.
Uh-oh.
Yes, it still works perfectly.
Listen and trust, follow me.
Jack Gillis says my experience is typical. He's with the Consumer Federation of America.
Extended warranties are really a bad deal. Think about it. You're paying a certain amount of money for something that probably won't happen.
Data from Consumer Reports shows that products don't usually break down during the time extended warranties cover, the first 2 or 3 years. So, like me, most consumers who buy the extra coverage never use it. That makes these plans enormously profitable for retailers. Joe Feldman is a retail analyst for the Telsey Advisory Group. He says extended warranties offset the deep discounts offered by big box stores.
It makes up for some of the discount. It makes up for
Yeah, the cost to ship it. There's all the different expenses that are out there, sure.
So if extended warranties are such a great deal for retailers and a bum deal for us, why do we keep buying them? We're responding to a basic instinct, the urge to avoid risk. Behavioral economists say risk aversion is as powerful a force as hunger. The instinct is strongest for big purchases. Back at that Maryland Best Buy, Randy Morgan just bought a $40 extended warranty on a flat-screen TV.
Better peace of mind for $40. It's covered for 2 years if anything happens to it. So just bring it back in, and I've used it once before.
Morgan had an extended warranty on a TV that later wouldn't turn off. He says Best Buy came in and fixed it. He's happy to pay for that kind of security. But this new TV he's buying the extra coverage on, it's not even for him. It's for his mother-in-law. He's making me look really bad here. And guess what? When I finally do buy something for my mother-in-law, I'll be extra tempted to get an extended warranty. Economist Kevin McCabe heads the Center for the Study of Neuroeconomics at George Mason University. He says we're even more risk-averse when it comes to gifts.
When we buy a present for somebody, often we want to demonstrate that we care with the present that we buy. And to some extent, an extended warranty does say you care, right?
Nothing says I love you like an extended warranty. McCabe says if you do want to buy one, do some research first. It might be worth the money if you're buying a product with a track record of breaking down, but resist the hard sell.
The service contract that's offered to you at the door often is not very competitive. It's an in-house product. There's no way for somebody to compare alternatives at that moment.
Retailers can charge whatever they want for extended warranties. The government doesn't regulate these plans. McCabe says look for alternatives. You can get extended warranties through some credit cards or tack a rider onto your homeowner's insurance. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace Money.
Now time to turn the mic around for your money questions. And here with me this week is David Lazarus, personal finance columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Hello, David.
Hey there.
I wanted to ask you about a recent column that you did for your newspaper about cable. And I think specifically you were talking about Time Warner. But I have a question for you. Why don't I have more choice in who my cable provider is? Basically, you move into an area and you're told who your cable provider is and that's it.
Well, the industry would turn around and say, oh, no, you have a cornucopia of competition out there from which to choose. You have your cable provider, which probably does have a geographic monopoly, but you can also turn to satellite or you can turn to AT&T's UVerse. And in a sense, they're right. To me, it's a closer examination of the actual model that all of these companies are using that merits scrutiny. And in my case, I looked at Time Warner Cable because they're the big dog in Southern California. And they sent out their annual letter, you know, holiday greetings, and guess what? Your rates are going up.
Merry Christmas.
And what's really troubling about this is how the rates go up like clockwork. I mean, let's face it, all businesses face increases to their costs, and most businesses pass those costs to their customers.
Right.
But the fact that the cable and satellite companies can do it with complete regularity raises a real question as to whether this is actually a reflection of their costs or whether it's something else.
What is the argument? Why do they say they need to raise the rates at this point? Well, isn't all the infrastructure in place?
You would think. But when I put that question to Time Warner Cable, they said, well, on the one hand, it's programming costs. But they also say, and we've made so many enhancements to our services that this reflects that as well. I would argue that all of these increases are basically a money grab, not just Time Warner, but all of these guys. And yet, what can a customer do, really? Now, to me,
that gets to my point. Okay, where's the choice unless you pay over and over and over again to change your service?
Yeah, but you're talking about switching provider to provider. And
right.
I would think the answer here has to be that you're not having these huge bundles and these huge packages foisted upon you. What we really need is a la carte pricing so you buy the channels you want.
All right, people, get outraged.
Yeah.
All right, well, are you ready to tackle some questions?
Oh, we got to do that too?
Yeah, I think so. Doug is with us, and he's in Burbank, California. Hi, Doug.
Hey, hi.
And I believe Doug is familiar to you, my friend.
That's right, because Doug sent me an email at my day job, the LA Times, after you heard us on our last go-round
around here.
That's right.
So then I, in the great circle of schemes, brought it right back to you.
Well, so you live in Burbank. That would make you either a pilot or an actor.
and actor and writer.
Yeah, you are an actor?
Yep.
Awesome. Anything you can say that we've seen you in?
I've got a couple commercials running now.
Ooh, fun.
Tell us.
One's for Capital One Bank and one's for Gushers.
You're not one of those barbarian guys, are you?
No, I'm one of those barbarian guys is marrying my daughter.
Oh, I hate it when that happens.
So do you have training in drama or comedy or...
Comedy, improv.
Where have you done improv?
I studied with the Groundlings.
Oh, the Groundlings. Okay,
that's like the Cadillac of improv.
Yeah,
half the people on Saturday Night Live got their start at the Groundlings.
Yeah, exactly. That's serious.
Well, boy, that sounds like a lot of fun. Have you found that you're able to make a living?
I'm not rich and famous, but I usually make a living.
So, how can we help you out then today? Can we get creative with your finances?
I hope so. I've got a free checking account with Chase Bank, mm-hmm. and at the end of November, I got a letter from them saying, your free checking account isn't going to be free anymore unless you have at least one direct deposit of $500 or more, or you keep a minimum daily balance of $1,500. Otherwise, it's going to be $10 a month, and I don't want to pay $120 a year to access my money. Can they just change the terms like that?
And let me guess, when you signed on, it was free checking for life, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. Well, David, we are hearing more and more stories about this, that banks are basically reneging on all the stuff that they told people years and years ago.
Yeah, and the banks are saying, don't blame us, blame all that pesky financial reform.
Of course.
They say that because we can't do these ridiculous overdraft fees and all those other things that we have onerously been gouging you with for decades now, well, now we're going to have to gouge you elsewhere.
Right.
And virtually every major bank is getting rid of free checking right now. And what the banks understand is that as more people get rid of checks and they're doing things with plastic, that plastic means fees. And they don't want to do anything to jeopardize the whole notion of plastic meaning fees. And so they're just saying free checking accounts are gone.
Doug, have you talked to your bank about whether they might, you know, just be nice and change this policy for you? Or have you gone bank shopping?
I've thought about it. There's the AFTRA SAG credit union. I thought of checking into them. But the Chase Bank is on the corner of my block where I live. So
yeah.
I can see it from my house.
Right. David, any solutions other than to switch banks?
Yeah, well, Doug's in the situation now where he's weighing convenience against the charges. Now, let's not minimize that. Convenience has value. But that said,
is it worth $120 a year?
Yeah, and I think free checking is something that's very important. And Doug was onto the right track a moment ago, and that is he mentioned credit unions. Credit unions are trying to become much more competitive with the big banks in this climate because they know that this is an opportunity. A lot of credit unions, even if you're not a member of the trade, will open their doors to you even through some circuitous route where you say, well, I knew a cop once or I knew a fireman once or something like that. You know, it's possible. So there might be a credit union that's more convenient to you that will actually welcome you as a customer.
Cool. All right.
So, Doug, it sounds like you have two choices. Either swallow the $120 a year to have that bank on the corner or make a move.
Yeah.
Or make a fabulously good career play, get a regular series or a franchise film, keep a lot of money in the bank, and everybody's happy.
I hope that happens.
Well, Shia LaBeouf can only do the Transformers film so long.
That's right.
At some point, they're going to need to look somewhere else.
All right. Well, good luck with that. Let us know what you end up doing.
Thanks a lot.
All right, David, our next caller's question came in through our email, and we just had to jump on it.
You know the rules. You know the lifelines. Ready to play? Okay, then let's play Millionaire.
Our next contestant was a contestant on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. Akiva is with us from Washington, D.C. Hi.
Hi.
What was that like?
It was a totally bizarre experience to show up, and then 20 minutes later, I was walking out with $100,000.
Jeez.
Is it like the movie?
It's like the movie, except you don't get beat up backstage.
Okay, much better. Much better.
Yeah, we're talking about Slumdog Millionaire, of course. So you made it all the way to the $100,000 mark.
Yeah, I did. And the strangest thing was signing the tax forms on the way out and realizing what it just happened. I work in the arts, so I'm not used to things like paychecks.
Now, I got to know, because I'm not a real aficionado of this show, what kind of question does a guy have to answer to score 100K?
All sorts of questions. The one that I actually won on was a question about Winston Churchill's interest in UFOs.
What?
Yeah, I hadn't even known that Winston Churchill had any interest in UFOs, but apparently he does.
Wait, but then how did you win the question?
I actually ask the audience.
So what goes through your head when you're deciding that the audience just might be right about this?
Well, the strange thing about it was that the place where I was in the game, I essentially had a free guess. If I had guessed and gotten it wrong, I would have had about $27,000. And if I had guessed and gotten it right, there was the opportunity to jump to 100.
Is it totally nerve-wracking when you're, you know, on camera under the gun?
The strange thing is that it's nerve-wracking immediately before and immediately after, but when you're in it, you're just in a zone. It's like an athlete or something. I can't explain it. It's like that time just disappears on you.
So how did you train for this then?
About 30 years of too much reading.
Okay, so we know that you walked away with $100,000, which means you did not walk away with $1 million. Was there a question then that you knew you couldn't answer, so you walked at 100K?
Yeah, I walked away on a question about, a really obscure question about state flags.
What was the question?
What state flag was designed by a 12-year-old?
Oh, I know that.
Alaska.
Oh, well.
Is she right?
Thanks,
she should have
been there.
Is she right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, Tess, oh. She shoots, she scores from downtown.
Do I get $100,000?
How impressive was that?
I'm a West Coaster.
Will you take a check?
Not if you're going to charge me for the account it's going
in. No.
All right. Well, we're having a lot of fun with this, but you obviously called us with a question. You want to know what to do with your 100 grand?
Yeah. I mean, I understand that, of course, after taxes, it isn't 100 grand, but it seems like getting a sort of magic money present from the heavens here a little bit.
Nice. Have you thought about what you want to do?
I thought a little bit of it because, I have some savings of my own, but it's a chance to really set myself up for much farther down the road, and it's money I don't have to touch for a little while.
Right. Well, okay, so let's go through the basic questions. Do you have an emergency fund?
I do. I have about 20-something thousand savings at this point.
And how many months would that last you in living costs?
In living costs, that probably lasts me about a year or so, maybe a little more.
$20,000 would?
Yeah, very possibly. My costs are very low.
Okay, great. Wow,
nice. How many beans can one man eat?
You would be amazed.
Okay, all right. Good to know.
And may I ask how old you are?
I'm 30 years old.
30 years old. Okay, so you've got some time.
Oh, yeah.
So he's got a lot of time for this money to grow. Where does he put it?
Well, I think this is another learning opportunity as well, and that is that Akiva has gotten a windfall. But this is a good example of what's called in psychological terms sudden wealth syndrome. And this is common to lottery winners. And that is they get a lot of money and they blow it.
Yep.
They don't know how to handle wealth. Now, my advice, and this is what the money mavens out there who have studied sudden wealth syndrome will say, and that is don't touch it. Set the windfall aside. Or in your case, put it in something just, low risk, either a mutual fund or a money market fund. But don't change your life in any way. Because when people come into money for the first time, they start improving, quote unquote, their lives. And more often than not, they're going to mess it up somehow.
But he just won a game show.
Mm-hmm.
Can he take at least some of that money and go have some fun?
Who doesn't want a Lamborghini? I'm hearing what you're saying.
No. I'm just talking, take a nice vacation. Go to Europe for a couple of weeks.
And then what you're doing is you're treating it as say, a jackpot at Vegas. It's suddenly this kind of thing where it doesn't matter. It's funny money. And I would say, no. You don't want to mess with something like that, especially in an economy like this. I would say you thank your lucky stars. And you set it aside. And then
How long?
Well, not for the rest of your life, obviously, and certainly not with a chunk this modest. But that said, you will handle that money better once you've gotten past that initial flash of, oh, my God, I've got money.
You're no fun.
I am no fun. And it's a wonder that anyone even married me when you stop and think about it. But that said, being conservative with your finances is a good thing because every time you hit an economy like we have now, you're not the one who's sweating bullets every day.
Well, maybe I'll just look at it as though I was on television and that was wonderful and I'll pretend that other part never existed and then see it again in 40 years.
All right.
No, I wouldn't go that far. I'd invest it prudently. I'm just saying don't blow it.
Okay.
And maybe a Lamborghini. I don't know.
Tess has visions of paradise dancing before her eyes.
No, I don't. I'm not saying the whole shooting match. I'm saying, okay, take $500.
All right, tell you what, Akiva, if you want to have some fun, set a budget and live within it.
There you go.
That'd be the way to do it. I personally would set the budget low, but if you're going to go have some fun and lose all your money, set a budget and don't go above it.
I think that's a good plan.
See you in Vegas, man.
Thanks.
Thanks for the call.
Bye.
Okay. Well, you know what? I want to hear from our listeners. So go to our Facebook page or send us an email at marketplace.org and tell us if you got a windfall, if you won a game show and you got this $100,000 that Akiva did, what would you do with it? Our voicemail is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And we spell that M-O-N-Y. Or better yet, do send us an email through the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. David Lazarus of the Los Angeles Times, Scrooge to you. Thanks for coming in.
Always a hoot.
And do remember to talk to your own financial professional before making any big money decisions. A few family members have asked me recently what I want for Christmas. It's kind of an awkward question to answer, right? Well, let's see. I want this, and I want this, and this, and world peace. But I'll tell you who's not shy about telling you what they want this holiday season. Charities. Nonprofits collect as much as 40% of their donations at this time of year, much of it thanks to all those fundraising appeals clogging your mailbox. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports on his own experience with the deluge of donor appeals.
I know it sounds backwards, but charities send money to me, like this nickel. It came taped to a fundraising letter. The appeal reads, "We make every nickel work as hard as possible." Really? Is sending money to strangers the most effective way to increase giving? I'll get back to that question in a minute. First, let's consider just how much charity junk mail the average person gets.
My name is Carol McBride, and I am pushing 90. I'm 89.
For the past few years, Carol McBride has cataloged all the mail she gets from fundraisers.
Just today, I received 66 address labels, 3 notepads, 10 Christmas cards, a little magnifier, and a batch of Christmas gift tags.
2007 was her biggest year.
I had a total of 868 solicitations, and that was from 338 organizations.
McBride says she doesn't donate much because she doesn't have much to donate, and she generally supports the same causes year after year. Still, she doesn't mind being courted by other charities within reason.
What I really don't like is the repetition from one company over and over and over and over again during the year. I understand that they need to make sure they catch you sooner or later, but once they've caught you, I wish they'd let you go for a while.
That's a frustration shared by many Americans. Ken Berger, president of Charity Navigator, says the overload of solicitations could backfire.
It actually doesn't just damage that charity. It damages the trust that many donors have in the sector as a whole because they're getting it from all different angles. And, you know, at a certain point, you can develop a general frustration with the whole lot of them for all this junk I'm getting.
Junk, to him, might be described by fundraisers as a premium. That could be anything from a calculator to a T-shirt to a tote bag. Remember the nickel I received in the mail? Children's Hospital Los Angeles says for every nickel it spends on the campaign, it makes a dime. The money helped pay for a new $600 million hospital. Ron Bell is president of ad agency Target Marketing. He says giving away coins can be smart business.
Many of the things you get in the mail, like greeting cards or something like that, are typically much more expensive than just 5 cents. And so in reality, although people say, why are you mailing out money, it's actually a fairly inexpensive premium.
Direct mail is still more effective than the internet in terms of fundraising, but direct mail is not exactly environmentally friendly. To attract just one new donor, nonprofits need to send about 200 pieces of mail. That's tons of paper in the trash. Again, Ken Berger with Charity Navigator.
The vast majority of people don't even open the envelopes, so it really is a tragedy, an environmental tragedy, this junk mail that is such a waste.
I emailed half a dozen environmental groups asking if wasteful direct mail campaigns undermine their goal of saving the planet. Just one replied. Jenny Powers is spokesperson for the Natural Resources Defense Council.
We recognize the environmental impacts of direct mail. And that's why we've taken steps to make sure we do it as sustainably as possible.
The NRDC sends all its correspondence on recycled paper. Also, Powers says the mailers aren't just about raising money. They help the organization update supporters about issues.
Direct mail is the most effective way to communicate with our members and fundraise.
Even critics of direct mail find it hard to resist. Ken Berger says Charity Navigator does send fundraising appeals to some donors, and next year it plans to send more.
We've been doing two a year. We may go up to three.
I probably shouldn't cast stones myself. I mean, direct mail is hardly unknown in public radio. Of course, when it's your own cause, junk mailers aren't just landfill. They're somebody's salary. Maybe somebody like me. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace Money.
If you want nonprofits to leave you alone, contact the Direct Marketing Association. Make sure to block mail from both commercial and charitable organizations. Now to the opposite of junk mail. Mail from you, dear listener. And for that, we welcome our mail lady, who also happens to be our senior producer, Deb Clark. Hi, Deb.
Hi, Tess.
You know what, though? I really don't need you anymore.
What? That's outrageous.
As you know, I am on Facebook.
Uh-huh.
So everybody friend me and then give your comments there. Guess what else I'm doing now?
I shudder to think.
Tweet. Tweet.
So are you an angry bird?
No, I am addicted to that game, though.
That's pretty good.
No, I am an at Radio Tess bird. So please, follow me, at Radio Tess. All right, now back to our regularly scheduled programming. What is up in mail land?
Well, let me start with a question for you.
Okay.
How was your holiday party last weekend?
Oh, it was lovely, thank you. I'm sorry you couldn't make it.
Yeah, me too. But I was out on vacation. So when I heard the show over the weekend, I was relieved that I had actually RSVP'd to tell you that I wasn't going to be there.
Yes, we did an interview with Prudy over at Slate.com asking why people do not répondez, s'il vous plaît. It's just so rude.
Yeah, sometimes we're forgetful there, but
yeah,
for the
yeah,
grace
yeah.
and all. Anyway, many people wrote in about this interview, including Vicky Lissman from Aurora, Colorado.
I was a working mother since 1968 and a full-time job and a husband, and I never found it a difficulty to respond to people's invitations. I do think that as time has gone on, people just seem to have less regard for others around these issues. But overall, I just think it's a sad commentary on our society.
I agree, but I wonder how many people here will work the piece.
I know, I wonder too. Maybe you'll get fewer ignored invitations next year.
Yeah, right.
So, meantime, another hot topic from a couple of weeks ago was our commentary with a tip on how to retire early.
Right. I believe the solution was do not have children.
Yes. Quite controversial. No surprise there, I guess. One slightly facetious suggestion came from Juan Blasquez in Milwaukee, who said he agreed and, quote, I also think you can eat nothing but ramen noodles and water for 40 years. Also, maybe never date anybody because during a special occasion, you might have to spend money on a gift.
Sarcastic much?
Yes, but quite a few people agreed with the commentary, too, including Margaret Parks from Ontario, Canada.
When we were newlywed in the mid-1970s, we were looking into financial planning, and one of the articles we read did have some calculations about the cost of raising a child, and this influenced us to decide to go childless by choice. Eventually, I retired at age 52 and my husband at 60.
So finally, Tess, I wanted to end on something a little different. So not really a reaction to a specific story, but more kind of a reflection on how things are like in this country right now, 2 years into the recession. We got a thoughtful letter from Nicholas Whitman from Williamstown, Massachusetts. He says he's enjoyed the show, knows the advice is well-meaning and accurate.
You're leaving room for a but here.
I might be. Listen for yourself.
I know I'm supposed to pay down my credit card debt and max out my 401k contributions. Stop nagging and please understand that economic reality has its own dictates, like day-to-day survival. I'm a self-employed photographer and have been since 86. Between the digital revolution and the recession, my profession has been decimated. I'm not whining or asking for advice. It's just the way it is.
I have to ask you as a senior producer, what exactly will we be advising listeners about, if not debt reduction and retirement planning?
Well, look, it is all good advice, but I do think this is more about how tough things are out there and have been for a while.
Thanks, Deb.
Thanks, Tess.
All right, folks, you heard it. Find us on Facebook, email, or follow me on Twitter.
Tweet.
And now for a trip down memory lane to Grover's Corners. Okay, it's not actually the mythical setting for the play Our Town. Instead, we travel to Cuba, Missouri, for Act Two of a different life cycle play. 10 years ago, correspondent David Brancaccio spent a week in Cuba, a town in the statistical middle of America. Much like his stage predecessors, David visited with high school students. And now he's gone back to catch up with them as part of our series called Economy 4.0. Our curtain rises, and David is looking back on the year 2000.
As it happens, Cuba, Missouri has the same population as Thornton Wilder's fictional Grover's Corners, about 3,000 people. I wasn't thinking of Our Town when I came here a decade ago. Back then, the idea was to see how globalization was playing out in Middle America, and Cuba, west of St. Louis, was the center by one U.S. Census measure. One piece of our original coverage was a stop at the high school, as social studies teacher Marilyn Licklider led students through an exercise in economics.
Does anybody know what productivity is?
What you make, what the outcome is, how much you make of it, how much you put out.
A lesson in finding more efficient ways to manufacture peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. Listening back 10 years later, I was struck with one section. It wasn't about grand economic principles. It was something more personal. I asked these high school seniors in December of the year 2000, before Enron, before 9/11, before the great collapse of 2008, I asked what they thought the future held for them.
I'd like to be a doctor in, like, Washington or Seattle.
Why so far away?
It's pretty up there, and I just really like it.
Everyone I asked envisioned their future somewhere else. 10 years ago, at age 17, Nikki Brees had this plan.
Nursing in a big city, because there's more of a need in bigger cities, and it's they pay more.
To paraphrase Thornton Wilder's play, the sun's now come up 3,650 times. That young woman is 28 and lives in a ranch house at the foot of the water tower that reads Cuba in big letters.
I'm a nurse, but in a small city.
Here in Cuba, Missouri.
Made it halfway there.
Nikki Brees Hulsey is married with two kids.
Let's see who can be the quietest the longest. Ready, go.
And there's another child on the way. Nikki works at a nursing home, which she says is what she can get with her more entry-level LPN, Licensed Practical Nurse certification. She's back at school to upgrade to registered nurse. It's been a busy 10 years.
I didn't expect that it would take so long to get things rolling, and I didn't think that I would go back to college so long after I got my LPN, but I changed my mind, so.
Hulsey is keeping up with her finances, but the new degree is costing her because it's more loans and no grants.
The actual grant part, I can't get any of it. I make too much. Still have to work, so that's not going to work for me.
A few blocks away, Allison Caudill was also in the Cuba High class of 2001. It wasn't long before fate threw her a jarring personal finance lesson.
I think that first year of college, my grandparents handed down an investment to me. We decided to teach me about the stock market then, and I invested and lost. I guess it was right when 9/11 happened.
Oh,
and
man.
In September, October, I lost $10,000 immediately. Oh, yeah, being a college student, that's a pretty good chunk of money.
Allison studied criminal justice, but a broken arm stopped her FBI plans. She got into banking first as a teller. A bank trained her as an investment advisor in 2008, just before the bottom fell out of the market. Now she's an insurance agent back in Cuba.
I would say we're probably in more debt than what we should be, but that won't happen again.
You're going to make sure that that stays under control?
Oh, yes, we have a very positive five-year plan.
You actually worked out a five-year plan.
In my head, yeah. I told my husband about it. How it's going to be.
Is this the first you're hearing about this plan?
No, actually it's not.
Allison and Joe are actually both graduates of Cuba High 2001, even if they didn't date back then.
No, I didn't even talk to him. He liked to wear crazy clothes that didn't match. So, and I got best dressed in high school.
So if Allison was best dressed, who was the most destined for big things?
I would have to say Marty Leathers. He will talk your ear off.
I went to see Marty Leathers, who used to talk about law school, but ended up at business school.
I didn't pursue myself back home. You know, I was the first one to say I'm heading out to bigger and better things.
He came back to town to start a truck driver training business with his dad, which is now running strong. When it came to real estate, he read the omens just right.
I've always been kind of a Wall Street Journal junkie, so I knew that it was a great time to sell my house and transition to another one if I was going to. I was lucky enough to be able to do it at the right time. May of 2008, we closed.
Marty was just elected county clerk and takes office in a couple of weeks. Of the 89 students who graduated from Cuba High in 2001, 65 of them entered college. There are no records on how many settled back in their hometown. Cody Cherry, now Cody Vagy, is one of those who got out, which was part of her original plan.
It's you, right?
I play her the old radio story where she's pressed for her aspirations.
Something to do with marketing or advertising, communications. Not here. There's not a lot you can do with advertising here. Probably go to Chicago, maybe end up there.
She's not there yet. Cody lives 2.5 hours away from Cuba in the Missouri town of Bowling Green, also population 3,000. She's now married and has an 18-month-old child. She teaches junior high and coaches volleyball, even as she completes her master's in education.
When I said, what do you want to do? 10 years ago, you said marketing or advertising, and you mentioned really big cities. What happened to that?
The big city didn't work for me. As far as that career path, I could still teach it. I'm just not doing it, so I could always go back if I wanted to whenever I grow up.
She says she feels lucky to be employed at a time when teaching positions are being cut. Her husband is in the pipeline business after doing residential construction before that market went slack. They had built a house.
You know, we're investing at least, but it's depreciated since we built, so, but everything else has, so it's a little depressing.
But I mean, you probably didn't want to move right away.
We had a plan. We were going to be there 2 years and then build again. And my husband, he's in construction anyway. So we wanted to build and sell and build and sell and eventually pay one off. So, but that is on the back burner for a little bit. We built one and now we're stuck.
Cody's not alone. Census figures show that migration within the U.S. has slowed recently to the lowest rate in 50 years. Some experts blame the tough real estate market on the theory that people who have trouble selling their houses are unlikely to move. But maybe they can visit. Specifically, what about Cody's old Windy City plan?
No, I've never even been to Chicago. Why haven't I been there? I'm in Bowling Green, Missouri, which is fine. I like it.
All right, so you're going to get your master's in June, and then July, you're going to somehow get over to Chicago. You might drive to Chicago from here.
Yeah, it's only 5 hours. I don't know. I'm always going the opposite direction. No, yes, I will.
In small town Missouri, I'm David Brancaccio for Marketplace Money.
And you can listen to David's original reporting from Cuba and read a blog post about his return visit at marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, a rebroadcast of our special report on what it takes and what it means to be rich.
$250,000 a year is definitely wealthy because I know a lot of people who are getting by on $15,000 to $25,000 a year.
If I made $250,000 a year, I think that I could do a whole lot.
No, I don't consider a household income of $250,000 a year as wealthy.
$250,000 a year is pretty decent.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Devin Robbins and Stephen Hoffman. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Viglund. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments. Recent tax law changes could mean new opportunities to save for retirement. You can talk to your financial advisor and get the latest news and insights at RothIRAblog.com. American Public Media.